This is Music Respawn. I'm Kate Remington, catching up with Marty O'Donnell. It's always great to have a chance to talk with you.
Kate, it is great to talk to you again from the snowy Pacific Northwest.
That's a switch. Normally, Connecticut is the one that's snowy. So.
I know, absolutely. Yeah, this looks like Connecticut.
That's really cool. Well, you have been busy posting just the most interesting project. And in all of my conversations with composers, I've never been able to experience kind of the early proto improvisations, I guess, or sketches, because by the time I get to hear it, it's all done. It's been put in the game and everything. So what you've done is to post your very earliest ideas for the music for what would become Music of the Spheres, and then later, of course, the music for The First Destiny. So, gosh, right off the bat, I was curious about what kind of got you inspired to go rummaging through your hard drive to find these things.
Well, the first thing that happened was I was doing something else, and I just happened to come across this a file, and it was sort of in a weird place, and it wasn't identified, and I played it, and it was that very first early improvisation that apparently had been turned into an audio file instead of just MIDI. And I listened to it, and I thought, oh my gosh, that's the very first little improvisation idea that I had for, you know, when I started thinking about Music of the Spheres. And so that actually prompted me to see how many of those things I could find. Like, how far back could I go? Could I go back to the origins of each one of the eight pieces? And when I started, I wasn't even sure I would be able to find or recreate all those things. So some have less material than others because I just didn't, you know, save everything or keep it, or I don't even know where to put my hands on it. But that's how that started. I randomly came across something. And it was interesting to me. So I thought, well, maybe it'd be interesting to some other people.
Well, what I find really fascinating about it is the way that you created the videos, because in a way, they're really intimate. It's just the black screen with, you know, text at like key moments and stuff. So how did that idea come about?
Okay, well, it's funny because I never thought about it before, but I thought, oh, I should just share this with, you know, on Twitter or with my fans or whatever. I'll just throw this music file up. And I thought, well, that's kind of weird. There's no explanation. And I was thinking, how do I make an explanation for it so people know what's going on? And I thought, well, I'll just put it on my YouTube channel. And I'm not good at YouTube and I'm not good at iMovie. So it seemed to me that last time I did something on iMovie for YouTube, it needed some sort of video. It didn't just want to have audio. So I thought, well, I'll see what iMovie can do. Like, what sort of image should I have? And I thought, well, I don't want people to be distracted by images because I want them just to listen to the music. So I thought, I'll just put a black screen up with a title. And then I looked, oh, there's other kind of title cards, and there's a little scrolling text, and I can just sort of share thoughts as I'm listening. So it just happened very organically. So it happened really fast. I just like, oh, well, that's fun. Right here, I was thinking whatever my thought was, and I'll just put that little title card up. And it was fun because there's different title graphics that they have with iMovie. Some things fade in, some things move across. Like, it's just funny little things that I thought, well, that's a fun way to do it. So that's how that happened.
It's really effective, and it's almost like, well, the experience that I had with it is, you know, like sitting in a corner of your studio while you're messing around with these things and then just tossing out comments as they come to you. So.
Well, you know, the thing that I'm nervous about, because I after the whole thing was over, somebody was begging me for the high res versions. Not you.
No.
You were never begging, but I was like, no, these are just MP4s. You know, don't take, you know, it's not about the quality of the sound. It's not about, I didn't spend any time fixing the MIDI. These are just sharing, this is how my process is. This is how you know, and I think a lot of composers probably work in a similar way where their very first sketches are rough and there's a lot of stuff that gets thrown away. But I was kind of amazed when I listened through these things. It's like, oh, well, there's a bit that I ended up using, and oh, there's a whole thing there that I didn't know was that well formed when I first sat down. And that was all sort of a surprise to me, too. So it was fun to share it that way.
You know, I have to say, if the whole composing thing doesn't work out, you know, you could have a bright future as a jazz pianist too. I mean,
I don't think so. There's an awful lot of flubby stuff going on in there.
Well, as you're sitting down and you've got what I imagine is kind of a blank screen in front of you, and you're just starting to touch the keys as you're improvising, do you have any idea where you're going to end up or a destination, or do you just kind of let the thoughts come?
Yeah, it's a combination of both things. I was playing some of these things for my wife, and she said something like, you know, people are going to just think this all came out in, you know, in one big, you know, spew. And I'm like, oh, that's true. What usually happens is I sit down and I mess about a little bit on the piano. And then when I feel like, oh, okay, there are some things here that I should keep messing with, but now I want to start recording, especially MIDI. I'm going to hit record on MIDI because I have a little bit of an idea of what direction I'm going in. And so then I want to capture whatever happens from that point. So I would say almost all of these things are, you know, I've been probably messing at the keyboard for 10, 15 minutes before I hit the red button and start recording. Because if you get too far away from your initial thoughts, you'll forget something or you won't know what's good. But the very first time I put my hands on the keyboard and I think, okay, I think I'm going to try this key or this kind of tempo. At first, I just sort of get comfortable with something. And if something sort of seems interesting, then it's like, okay, time to hit record and go in that direction.
Yeah. I love the moment in the very first improv where you've hit on that little destiny hook. And and it's just so fun to kind of hear it come out of what you've just been playing.
Yeah, actually, I think that might have been the first time I ever played that. That's my memory, is that I had started doing this thing in that Lydian flat seven mode, and I just hit those chords, and I'm like, okay, yeah, I like that. So I kept going back to it. It sort of became like this little touchstone. Like if I needed to reset my thoughts, I would play that again and then start in. So that might be the first time I played that. Yeah,
that was exciting. And what's so cool is, you know, knowing what all came afterwards, to hear it just right there is just really cool.
Well, you know, a few months ago, I had found this old video I had done with Steve Vai for Halo 2, and I shared that with the fans, and I thought, well, you know, there'd be a few hundred fans that might find this sort of hardcore old thing interesting. And of course, it turned out to be a huge, there were hundreds of thousands on my side and a million people looking at it someplace else. Now, that's Steve Vai, so that's pretty amazing. But a very similar thing happened in that session where his very first time improvising through with the track, he ended up doing things that are directly used in the final mix and in the final Mjolnir mix theme that was part of Halo 2. And I didn't think how significant that would be to the fans, for them to see that lick and those licks actually happen for the very first time. And everybody seemed so excited by that. I thought, oh, well, that is interesting. Of course that's interesting. But it's the way all of us work. We all know that, you know, something happens for the first time, and if you get that, if that's recorded and it's good, you might as well use it. So it's not a surprise to a lot of composers or producers. But then I realized, okay, there's probably a lot of fans and other people who just don't realize that's the way things happen.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. And what's cool is I went back and watched that video that you did with Mike, oh gosh, maybe in 2013. And mm-hmm. The video starts with you playing the piano and that little theme.
Yeah.
And you even said, well, you can say destiny to that little motive.
Destiny. Yeah, I know.
One of the things that I've noticed listening to these tracks, because most of them are solo piano, so they're kind of bare bones. You know, the harmony is there, of course, but they're very simple, these motives. And so have you found over the years that a simpler melody or a simpler motive gives you actually more to work with as you expand it?
Well, that's a good way to put it. So I guess one thing I learned studying composition that I took with me, and I decided I like that approach. You know, if you listen to Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, it's amazingly complex and just a work of genius. But it's da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da. I mean, sorry, but you just don't get much simpler than that. And I actually also did a study on Berlioz when I was in college. And I remember his Symphony Fantastique, you know, which has this, I forget what he calls it. He doesn't call it a leitmotif.
It's the idée fixe.
Yeah, idée fixe, right. Wow, I just failed my own paper. but the idée fixe in that symphony was very complex and long. And it sort of like said, every time he had to use it in any of the movements, it ended up pretty much coming out very much the same way as it was originally written. It's a beautiful theme, and it works great, of course. Who's going to complain about that symphony? But he came back to that concept later on with a piece called Harold in Italy, and he had a much simpler idée fixe, and he was able to use it in a lot more interesting and sort of secret-y ways all through the rest of that work, because it wasn't so long and complex. So I thought that was interesting. It was just sort of something I felt made sense. And then, of course, doing jingles, there's no such thing as a complex jingle. You got to get in, get out, and it's got to stick in people's brains. So that's just a way that I like to work. It's not necessarily, you know, the only way to do things, but I do like doing that. And I'll start with something that's more complex than I want it to be, and I'll try to pare it down to its essentials. Because I know that in the long run, something that's simple but hooky is more malleable. You can mutate it in a lot more different ways. So that's why I do it. And I even with harmony, I tend to say, you know, two voices can do amazing stuff, and three voices can really help define harmonic structures. So a lot of times I'm just sitting, how can I pare this down to three voices and see what happens? So, for example, the ecstasy is almost, that entire theme is basically just three voices.
Wow, I hadn't really thought about that, but yeah. And what I also like about the sketch that you put up there is that you really get a sense with the fanfare, especially, of those, you know, wide open, like fourths and fifths. And it's so interesting to hear just how solid that is. And what's also cool about it is we get to hear you experimenting with it.
Well, and the other thing is that traditional common practice harmony is tertial, and so that means that essentially when you thicken the harmony, you're just building and stacking more and more thirds and making the harmony itself more complex and colorful. And I tend to gravitate towards the Copland-esque kind of harmonies where I like the ambiguity of fourths and fifths. You don't necessarily know major and minor all the time. And so a minor chord tells you something, a major chord tells you something else. And those are the two main ingredients of tertial harmony. But as soon as you say, just do an open fifth, you don't know if it's major or minor, and it can be anything. And so, you know, something that's just built in fifths. So like C, G, D, that's just a beautiful chord, and it doesn't say major, it doesn't say minor. So I like using triadic harmonies, so three voice harmonies, but they're not necessarily built in thirds. They're just the concept of three voices.
And what's cool about them is that you can take them in a lot of different directions. You can go major or minor. And so the transition from the fanfare to that absolutely gorgeous hymn is really seamless because you've set it up so that, you know, anything can happen after the fanfare.
Yeah, thanks.
So, yeah.
It's funny, I didn't know I still had that particular version of the fanfare, which was just me just sort of saying, okay, that was definitely off the top of the head and just experimenting with fourths and fifths and thinking brassy sounds in my head and not trying to be in 4/4. And So anyway, that's, it just struck me funny when I heard it, because it's like, oh yeah, there's lots of little details that ended up in the final, but you have to really go searching for them through that sort of messy stuff I did.
Thank you.
What's also really interesting is that you left in stuff that didn't work, like the track that's identified as piece two, which eventually would become The Union. There were some false starts there, which is really interesting.
Well, that was, and that's funny too, because I was happy when I found that, because I didn't have that on all the pieces. I didn't keep necessarily every thought that came out of my head. I just undo. I would just hit, control Z and undo it. So I would just disappear forever. But for some reason, I kept those, that sort of progression of trying to make sense out of something. And for me, the funniest part was that little ending Irish jiggy thing that I went into. And I was like, wait, what? It's like, and I'm almost positive at the time I was like, oh, no, Marty, don't do the Irish jig again. Just cancel that. So that's why I put that in there.
Backing up, what was it about those early couple of attempts that didn't strike you as anything that was going to work out and be useful? I mean, what wasn't working for you about those?
Well, I mean, the first thing I did on that, and I do remember this progression, was that I thought, okay, I enjoy doing slow, elegant sort of pieces and things that are somewhat romantic, but I definitely need to do something that's mercurial, but also sort of dark and bombastic and fast. So I just randomly chose this fast tempo, and I knew what key I wanted to be in. And then I started playing. And so the very first attempt, I knew immediately after I played for a bit that I was listening to this click track that was driving me forward, but I wasn't playing the fastest notes. I wasn't playing 16th notes. I was just playing quarter notes and, you know, dotted quarters or whatever I was doing. It was just, I had ended up slowing it down by not playing the micropulse. So I was like, okay, so cancel that. And now remember that here's the micropulse. I need to hear that micropulse as a thematic material in order to keep the piece fast and driving. Because you can have a fast tempo, but if you do whole notes and half notes, it ends up sounding slow. It's no longer fast.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's why I went back and I'm like, okay, I got to come up with a micropulse thematic material. So that's the progression it made.
That's so interesting. I heard a funny story about Schubert that he was a good pianist. I mean, obviously a very capable pianist, but he wasn't a virtuoso. And yet he wrote this music that basically he couldn't play, but he knew somebody would be able to. And so I'm wondering, do you wrestle with that too? I mean, are you writing stuff that's like beyond your capabilities, but you know somebody's going to be able to play it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Even if I thought I could play everything I wrote, I would have to practice, and I don't like practicing anymore. So, yeah, and this is what makes sequencers and digital audio workstations so great for composers, is that we can try to just stay in the realm of our imagination and what the possibilities are, without thinking that we have to be able to perfect it or play it ourselves. So, what I like about these early sketches is that I'm not trying to be accurate. I'm just trying to get the emotional, correct feeling to come through, even with all sorts of flubs and wrong notes. Because I know I could always go back in and fix everything, but I want to keep that a sort of emotional truth that comes out that I like, and I want to see if I can keep that going all the way through to the end of a production.
The piece, I guess it's the next step, and I can't remember exactly where that falls in the sequence, but you explain that you're playing one of the really beautiful main themes, but you have to do it absolutely to tempo. You can't fudge with the tempo, no rubato at all, so that the notes end up in the right place. And so how does that work?
Well, see, and this is, and when I teach classes or I speak before composition classes and stuff, and a lot of these kids are coming up, and all they know how to do in terms of composing is to work with a sequencer. And my problem with all sequencers is they tend to force everybody down the same path, which is here's a tempo, here's a metronome, work with it and quantize all your notes into that pattern. So you end up, everybody sounds like they're doing dance music all the time, because that's great for dance music. It's great for rock and roll. It's not good for classical music or music that breathes and has rubato. So I almost always tend to start with no tempo and no click track, and I'm just freely playing. So I can play even rough ideas with a sense of breathing and rubato and space and speed ups and slowdowns. I wish that there was a very simple way then to take the next step and keep all the rubato in the performances, but it's much harder in sequencers to line all this stuff up when it's just, you're just layering a free performance, layering on top of a free wheeling performance. So it's just easier at that point to sort of lock everything into a tempo so you know exactly where the notes have to go. Later, sometimes with even in the MIDI rough mock-ups, I'll go back in and do a tempo map and put some rubato in. But if I know that there's going to be live performers with a conductor and I don't have to do the final production to sync to picture, let's say, then I'd rather have the musicians and the conductor and the room itself that it's being recorded in, I'd rather have them beyond what we call on the stick. So the conductor is conducting, and if he feels like, you know, a fermata and a pause between phrases needs extra breath, he just does it, you know, so that that's how that happens.
What's cool, I would imagine, about having the click track for these two is that then you know exactly, like, what the metronome markings are supposed to be.
Yes.
So that everything will line up and be exactly the way you intended it. Because I'm sure when it's implemented in the game, it has to be exactly a really specific tempo, and you can't, like...
Well, you know, that's actually interesting. And I've talked to other game composers, and I'll say, hey, did you get to do any of the music with some rubato? And they're like, no, we had this system that we had to stay locked to a tempo so we could do these things that cut on beats or measures or whatever. And I'm like, you know, that's not really true. You don't have to do that. I'm not saying that to their face. I'm just saying it to myself, that I've done a lot of music in a lot of games that have a lot of rubato in them. And you can still do rubato, and you can do interactive music that with vertical interactivity and horizontal interactivity and adaptive music that still has some give and take and some breath in it. You just have to, you have to work at it. You have to be very specific about it. You can't have some sort of hard baked in metronomic system that triggers branching music based on quantized sort of beats. And sometimes that works really well to do it that way. So yes, let's do this all at 120 or 132 or something. But there are other times where you can have music that's much more, has a lot more breath and rubato, and that works really well. And you just, you use your transition points to be at the ends of phrases or with long crossfades or something like that.
Yeah, and I would think that that would, well, I mean, I know because I've experienced it in some rare occasions, but it definitely makes the music feel much more alive. And because it's alive, the whole experience of being in the game world is like way more immersive.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's very cool. Speaking to staying on a very specific tempo, one of the pieces that I still just find so intriguing is The Ruin, which is the music for Venus. And what's so interesting about it is, you know, you told me when we talked earlier that you kind of thought that this was a code or data, a stream of data that we interpreted as music. And that early piano sketch is so interesting because it almost sounds kind of minimalist.
Well, so process music was something that I thought I invented back when I was in college. And then, of course, I found out that people have been doing it for decades, and I stumbled on something. Believe it or not, I remember coming to my composition prof and showing him this thing that he says, well, that's what you're doing there. It's called metric modulation. And I'm like, I don't know what that is. And he says, well, that's what you just did. It's just a metric modulation. And he didn't minimize it. He was like, no, that's very good. You did metric modulation. And I'm like, oh, geez, you mean somebody else already invented this? So, of course, I had to go and study Elliot Carter for a while and realize that he had taken it way beyond my simple, hey, this is cool. But I've always loved the basic concept of, once again, micropulse, which gives you the sense of a more macro pulse. So you're and basically it breaks down in terms of the felt, what most people can feel as pulse is either threes, breaks up into threes, or breaks up into twos. So, I mean, even 5-4 doesn't really necessarily feel like five. It's either 1-2-3-1-2 or 1-2-1-2-3, right? So I've always enjoyed doing, especially on the piano, little metric modulation things. And I thought, well, it's minimalist. It looks like a code. You can have a lot of repeating notes, a lot of little triples or duples, and you can end up making music out of that by combining a process that has a lot of repetition. And so I thought, well, that's just a sort of a fun compositional process if I'm trying to get across this sort of vague concept of musical code coming from deep within the galaxy. So that's why I went in that direction.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And the video that you used, one of the rare occasions where you showed the video, is it really does look like a stream of code with the little notes.
Yeah, it looks like old punch cards or something coming.
Yeah.
Thank you.
you know, we've mentioned that a lot of these are you sitting at the piano, but in a couple of cases, because you knew you were going to write or score the piece for strings, like the Tribulation, you just went, loaded up your samples and just went right there. So
right.
In the creative process, what does that allow you to do that just sitting at the piano doesn't?
Well, so I'm comfortable at the piano, and I'm sort of comfortable, you know, I was a flute minor, believe it or not, at one point. So I feel pretty good about woodwinds. When I took brass techniques, I was horrible. Brass is very hard, so I never pull out anything brass, but I pull out brass samples. It's just that sometimes piano, if you start at the piano, it's going to take you in a direction, even if you orchestrate it. So a lot of times I like to get off the piano as soon as possible to see other colors and what might happen. But certainly if I know that I want something to be, you know, beautiful, lush, languid, slow strings, it's not good because the piano is a percussion instrument and you don't get any sustain. So it's sort of like, you know, if I was going to write an organ piece, I probably wouldn't start on the piano. I'd probably start on an organ because organ sustains everything through, and strings sustain, and choir sustains, and brass and woodwinds all sustain their tones. So when I know that that's the direction I want to go in, I'd rather have those kind of samples to start with, just to see if it, because I don't, my imagination isn't strong enough to know how that's going to sound and feel unless I'm hearing it. So that's why I do that.
I was also thinking about, there was a story about Chopin just, I guess, complaining or super, super frustrated because there he'd be at the keyboard and he just had a hell of a time getting what he had just played down on paper. And so what I'm wondering is, as you're playing things into the computer, this is pretty basic and I maybe should know this, but how does it actually turn into a manuscript?
Well, especially if you're not playing to a click track, you just have a bunch of random notes and durations that if you were just to say, hey, let me see the score version of this, like there are, you know, you do have the ability to immediately see notation, but the notation is completely confusing because it's not interpreting where you think the downbeats are. It doesn't know what you think. So you have to go back into that performance and say, no, this is, I'm holding, there's this fermata on this note, and then I slowed down here, and this is actually supposed to be the downbeat. And you have to sort of go in, and without changing your actual performance, you have to sort of tell the computer what you intended it to be. And, you know, I feel privileged that when I was in college, there were no computers to help out with all this stuff. You did have to do what Chopin had to do, which is whatever you performed, you had to be like, okay, well, how do I get somebody else to perform what I just did? I gotta put it on essentially graph paper, which is what music manuscript is, and I have to put my instructions on there that are clear enough that somebody else can do what I just did. And that actually is a craft that is starting to be lost. And I would highly recommend all the young composers out there to never go away from manuscript and like, okay, big shot, you just did a fantastic performance at the piano. prove it. Write it down. Let me see how you write it down. And that's actually a stumbling block to a lot of composers because of that very thing. It's just like, well, I know what I want and I know how to play it, but I don't know how to put it on paper. And the computer doesn't necessarily help you. I've seen tons of Finale and Sibelius scores that are like, no, this is not what you intended. This is what Sibelius is saying it thinks you did. You have to go back in there and, you know, correct it and edit it and make it so it's clearly understandable music to the rest of the musicians out there who know how to read.
Yeah. Wow. What a painstaking process. Jeez.
Oh, no. It's horribly painstaking. Yes. I wouldn't recommend it to anybody. But if you're a composer and you feel like that's what you need to do, you got to learn that craft.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Well, and then you can come kind of see it from the instrumentalist's point of view, too.
Oh, yes. Oh, and by the way, this is just an aside, but I've conducted the union a few times, and I don't know if I told you this last time, but I'm so disappointed in myself because I completely barred and have the wrong meter, tempo, and barring for that entire piece, which makes it really hard to conduct. It's like I did this fast, you know, which is really should be, I should have done it all in 12/8 or 4/4 with a, you know, triple micropulse. So I should have done it 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, da 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 da. You know, I should have done that. And I can't just conduct it that way and have everybody follow me because they're like, no, I'm just seeing 1, 1, 1, 1. So it's not good. And if I ever go back to, I would rescore the whole thing. It would be this exact same music, but I would just rebar it so it's easier to perform and conduct.
Yeah, see, that's stuff you don't think about when you're just sitting there at the piano. And
well, you should. And it's my fault. I should have thought about that. Because I was never a conductor, and you know, I get to sort of guest conduct and do a few things. But from this point forward, I'm going to always say, okay, you've chosen this meter, you've chosen this tempo, but what if you were going to conduct it? And then I'm like, oh, of course, I should change it up.
Good, mm-hmm. Good plan going forward for sure.
Yes. But see, that's the thing. Once you sort of go, you know, like once you've taken a few next steps where you've locked in a tempo and you're quantizing your notes to eighth notes or 16s or whatever you're doing, you get down that path far enough and you go, this whole thing should be in a different meter, and you don't feel like doing that because you're too far down the road. So that's the lazy way. You should definitely start over and make it right.
Yeah, because I'm sure in the long run it's going to be easier on everybody if you do it right.
Oh yeah,
the first time. Yeah, for sure. So when we talked, I guess it was just over a year ago, right after the Music of the Spheres suite was leaked, you sent me this file of your really early sounds, kind of like an audio, I don't know, an audio thumbprint or signature of one of your very first pieces. And
yeah, which I included in this latest batch.
Yeah, video. Which is so cool. And you've expanded it. There's more. And what I love about it is it's almost like listening to the, I don't know, like the kind of background radiation of the sound. So where in the process did you start working on those pieces?
Well, that's why when we talked a year ago, I had found that file, and I was sort of surprised because that was in a bunch of files that had to do with a presentation we were doing for the team. And at that point, we were presenting work on ODST, work on Halo Reach, and some very early work, just like concept art for what was eventually going to become Destiny. And so I had forgotten, that's why I included it, I had forgotten that I had already decided, well, I think I'm going to try this kind of cool spacey Lydian flat 7 mode. And we already sort of just conceptually had this idea that something was reaching out from the center of our galaxy trying to communicate with our solar system. So that's why I just thought, oh, okay, I'll do some cool, creepy, you know, spacey sounds, but I'll have them all in this sort of Lydian flat 7 pool, you know, sort of this montage of this key center. But I had forgotten that I'd also done this little vocal thing, which was the faux Latin names of the planets, and I was singing this little thing that was still Lydian flat 7. And because that was in there so early, and it was just sort of fun, and then the angel, space angels sort of sing from a distance, and I had done a couple of pieces like that. Well, I think the original thing was, here's the walk-in music and here's the walk-out music, which meant this was the music that played in the theater where we were presenting to the team. And this music was just background music that played to, you know, bring people into the mood as they walked into the theater. And then as they walked out, that was the music they would hear. So it was just, it was two files, walk-in, walk-out. But what's, because I'm lazy and I never want to throw anything away, it's like, of course I went back to that a couple of years later, which is when I started working on Music of the Spheres, and said, okay, I think I've already got a little runway here that I started. Well, is there anything I can use out of there? So that I used a lot.
It adds so much because it really does feel like it's coming from deep, deep space, and just gives an extra layer of, it's really intriguing. It's like, how did this get here?
Well, yeah, I mean, that was like, it was just like the, it was mysterious, strange, and ethereal. So those were, for me, that was what I wanted that to sort of evoke.
Yeah, and I loved how you described one of the parts of it is the space angels, because... that's totally what it is. I think actually it ended up being put in the game when Ghost finds you right at the very beginning.
Yeah, and that's what the, okay, now the music gets sad.
Yeah.
The sad part for me was I didn't get to be there at the very end to know where everything that I had, you know, initiated and started working, and how that was all going to end up being presented in the game. I was close, but I don't have a good sense right now of where people have even heard some of these things in the game, because I just don't know exactly how everything got implemented. So, there are some times I'll play something and then somebody goes, oh yeah, that's the Great Awakening. And I'm like, I don't even know what you're talking about. So I went and looked up the Great Awakening, and I'm like, oh gosh, well, there it is. Sure enough, it's, you know, it was made into a piece that I didn't actually make or name that particular piece, the Great Awakening, but it goes all the way back to, you know, 2008 or something.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, it's kind of like looking at the Lascaux cave paintings, just listening to these early sketches. Because everything is there, but it's just in such an early stage. And that's what makes it so fascinating. And I love how you really got into the weeds as far as music theory with piece number 7, which ended up being The Prison, because you really break it down. And there's a great chunk that includes that tone row that went in there. And I didn't even notice it at first, but boy, once you hear it, once you notice it, it's it really gets under your skin.
Well, you know, and I see, I'm not a fan of listening to serial music. So I have a ton of respect for a lot of serial music. So atonal serial music, I mean, the reason for serialism is to try to minimize any pitch center as feeling like home. And that's just not necessarily the way I work. Even if I'm doing quote-unquote atonal music, it's usually, there's usually a pedal tone screaming through the whole thing. So that defeats the purpose of what normally serial theory is about. But I do enjoy, you know, I do know that if you're using a major scale or minor scale or any of the modes, it's always going to give you a sense of a home, you know, of a tonic. And so if I tried on that one to say, okay, I'm going to do sort of like a tone row that is doesn't really have a pitch center and never repeats any notes. I only did 7 notes, which is kind of a cheat. You should do 12 if you're going to be more accurate with serial. But 7 was good for me. I like the number 7. I was going to be in 7. And so that's why I did that. I was trying to do something that was, you know, felt atonal, didn't have a necessarily a sense of tonic and could have aleatoric strings and stuff. So,
yeah. And again, it just illustrates the really wide range of the character of each one of these pieces. And so, because it doesn't sound like anything else in the suite, which obviously was the goal. But so do you have plans to add any more of these, or are you kind of finished now?
What was interesting to me was that I found all the very this is sort of like the origin story of each piece. I actually found the earliest origin of each one of the eight pieces. And yeah, it seems like that's a good story. So now it's done. But who knows? I mean, I might go back through the files and say, oh gosh, here's some early Halo 1 stuff. I'm sure it's in there someplace. My archives are not super well organized. That's why I'm surprised when I find something. But if I go searching for something, I might do something in Halo or ODST or who knows. We'll see. It was a fun and actually quick process for me. I didn't have to spend that much time on them. And, you know, I would just grab the track, the audio track, stick it into iMovie, and then everything was black until I decided, oh, I can use this cool star background. I mean, I started doing other things. But, you know, it's like, okay, here's the title. And then if I had a thought at any given point, I would just stick a new little text box there and say, here's what I'm thinking right this minute. And then I would just go from beginning until I got to the end, and then boom, print it out, and there it is.
Amazing. Well, the whole progression is just so fascinating, you know, for anybody who cares about the music of Destiny and the story of how it got created. And boy, Marty, it's been great to catch up with you and really dig in and find out more about this. So thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Kate. I really appreciate that you're interested. I didn't know if anybody would be interested, but like I said at the beginning, I'm old enough now that I'm not embarrassed about my, you know, early meanderings. Like, it's like, yeah, so what? That's the way I work. Like, but I have a feeling there's a lot of young composers out there who might think they hear all this polished, wonderful music all around them. And, you know, none of that stuff starts out that way. I wanted to make sure that the young composers realize that, you know, everybody puts their pants on one leg at a time, or whatever is the non-sexist way of saying that. Sorry. But, you know, it's like nothing is great at the beginning. Everything is a sketch. And one thing I learned even when I was doing art, I did some painting classes and drawing classes. And one of the professors said, you know, this is horrible, this thing you just drew. And I'm like, yeah, I'm just sort of sketching. He goes, yeah, but if you stop at every step of the way, it should still be art. So your very first pencil sketch should still, no matter how simple it is, it should still be artfully done. And I thought, okay, that's a good way to think. And even the earliest pencil sketches of the music, I think it's still sort of interesting to listen to. It's not finished, but it still should evoke emotions and feel like it's artistic. So that's why I thought I'd share that. So encourage everybody for what they're doing.
That's so cool. Well, thank you again. This has just been so much fun and so interesting.
Thanks, Kate.